From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Monday, Kate Kelly was notified by her bishop that she'd been excommunicated for her role in advocating the Mormon priesthood for women. So now what? That's what today's show is about. What's next for Kate Kelly? Personally, as she said, this is a deeply personal matter for her. But there are also broader questions here. What does all of this mean for Mormon women and what seems to be an emerging movement of Mormon feminists? Will this embolden women to push forward, or will it cause the movement to recoil or retreat? This is also raising questions about strategy. Did Kate Kelly just make a tactical mistake? Did she push too far? And if you're a Mormon woman, what is the right way to ask for change? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Monday, Kate Kelly's bishop in Virginia sent her an email, along with a certified letter, just in case, to tell her the result of a disciplinary council that her leaders had held on Sunday. The bishop said she had been excommunicated for her public role in the Ordain Women organization that, of course, is the effort to push the LDS Church to bestow its priesthood on women. The letter did not mention the word apostasy, but that she was being punished for, quote, conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church. Now, if you're a Mormon and a devout one, excommunication is the most drastic of punishments. For believers, it has profound spiritual implications. It severs eternal ties with loved ones. It keeps people from going to the temple, from participating in church, from praying in public. To use the parlance of American politics, it's the nuclear option for Mormons. And Kelly's excommunication is raising big questions about its effect on women or an emerging movement of Mormon feminists. Today in the program, we are exploring the impact of this story, and we invite you to join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Kate Kelly, founder, of course, of Ordained Women, is with us here in the studio, and welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Okay, so I guess the first question I wanted to get at was, honestly, truly, were you surprised?
I was shocked. I was stunned. I read the letter that was sent to me by email, and I opened up my cell phone, and I saw that the letter was several pages long.
Right.
And I knew that was
not good.
Bad news.
Yeah.
I was actually sitting at a board meeting at a table with all of the other executive board members of Ordained Women. And until that moment when I saw that it was several pages long, I still had hope for good news.
Yeah.
I immediately started sobbing. I couldn't read the actual words of the letter because I just couldn't wipe away the tears enough.
So you were not expecting. Why? And is this based on a sense of faith? I mean, you have talked about this. You prayed and you prayed and you figured, what, God would have your back? That God would intervene?
I think when we went to the priesthood session in October of last year, I may have been the only person who thought we would actually get in. I walked up to that door with full confidence that we would be permitted to enter. And some people thought that was a farce and we were just doing it for show. But I personally thought we would actually get in. And I think until I got that email, maybe I was the last person in Utah or on the planet that thought I wouldn't get excommunicated. But I had hope and I just had faith that that wouldn't happen.
I want to key on that word faith because it seems like, and I think I've heard this from a lot of devout Latter-day Saints, that faith is a kind of an expression of that you have to act. That's what faith is. So is that what you're saying? That public protest on the, you know, on the property of the LDS Church, there that was an act of faith. And because on one hand, people could say, Kate Kelly, that's so naive. But you didn't see it that way. You saw it as an expression of action of faith.
Absolutely. And I think we learn, and I've said this many times, we learn in the scripture that you have to knock for the door to be opened. Knocking isn't in your mind. Knocking isn't thinking something to yourself. Knocking isn't writing about it in your journal. Knocking is doing something about it. It's an action. And so everything I've done is, in my estimation, a confirmation of that active faith.
Let me ask you, I want to come back to this point a little bit later, so let me set that aside for a moment. But do you have any regrets? Clearly, this is the question. The question, and it came up in some of the consultation from your leaders, that, Kate, you can think whatever you want. But it's your tactics that's problematic. Do you regret going onto the property of the church? I mean, couldn't you have just... apparently you made some leaders angry. You kind of embarrassed them. It may have made them less willing to actually listen to what you may have said because your tactics were so sort of in their face. Do you regret any part of that?
Well, first of all, I don't think I embarrassed them. If they did something embarrassing, that's on them. But I don't regret what I've done, because what I've done is live with integrity. In the young women's program of the church, one of the values that we learn and memorize and talk about every week is integrity. And integrity is yellow and good works is purple. And those are suffrage colors. And what I've done is a combination of good works and integrity.
I wanted to get what you think, your sense of the idea of how change might work in your church. Do you still think of it as your church?
It's 48 hours out, and it's a difficult – it's been a difficult couple of days, but I will always consider myself Mormon. Yeah. I think they can take my church membership, but they can't take away who I am and how I was raised, and they can't take away my testimony.
So I want to ask you about how you see change working. And whether you've thought this through, let me ask you this. What would have happened if a church leader had agreed to meet with you, like a general authority, let's say, and they took you aside and they said, Kate, look, I get what you're saying, but this church isn't quite ready to go all this way. We're not quite ready to ordain women yet. But in the meantime, we got the message. We got it from you. We've gotten it from others. We're going to let women speak give prayers in general conference. We're going to start, we're going to televise the priesthood session, if not let you in. We're going to do that. We've done a couple of things here. We're making changes. It's a gradual process. Just back off a little bit and give us a little bit of room. We're elderly gentlemen here. We don't get exactly where you know what I mean? Just a sense of like understanding maybe where they're coming from. Do you know what I mean? What would have happened if somebody would have said something like that to you?
I think that question presupposes a dialogue, and that's what we wanted to engage in. We sent multiple formal requests to meet with leaders, including but not limited to the auxiliary leaders of the church, the female leaders of the church, and we got no response. And I would love still to this day to have a dialogue. I know they meet with non-members. I know they invite them to Temple Square. I know they meet with LGBTQIA activists. And so I still have open arms to engage in that dialogue. I think the church needs to listen to people like me, in addition to all the other people who are advocating for greater gender inclusion in different ways. And it doesn't just have to be listening to people who, toe the party line. They should listen to people who are trying to invest in different ways.
I wonder if... Let me just put this question. It's a pretty straightforward question. Is anything short of ordination for women at all acceptable to you at this point?
The reason that we chose the name Ordain Women is because we want to make it very clear that gender inequality in the church is an institutional problem. It's not one individual bishop being mean or antagonizing one individual person. It's the entire institution and the way that it's set up. And the reason that women have no access to opportunity or to leadership or to perform ordinances is because they are not ordained. Now, I don't think that's a panacea. I don't think ordination, if it happened tomorrow and Thomas S. Monson got a revelation saying that women were to be ordained, I don't think that would solve all the problems. I think, you know, we still don't have racial inclusion in the leadership of the church, even though black men were ordained in 1978. So it doesn't automatically solve all the problems, but it really gets at the fundamental root of gender inequality.
Some have been making the connection between this particular issue and the matter of blacks in the priesthood, which you just referred to, that there's a kind of similar trajectory here, where over time, church leaders did change, or they said God was ready for change. Whichever it might be. Do you see the similar kind of thing where there's some sort of doctrinal squishiness about whether or not blacks shouldn't have held the priesthood in the first place, that these were sort of just traditional views espoused from the pulpit? The same kind of thing, I think, some say, exists for women in the priesthood. You can't really identify a particular Mormon doctrine in that there's going to be change, but that change took decades with blacks in the priesthood and might similarly in some way for women in ordination.
We've never said that the timing is our timing. We have continually said that we support the prophet and that we ask them to prayerfully consider the ordination of women. The name of the group isn't Ordain Women Now. The name of the group is Ordain Women. And so what we're seeking is a dialogue. What we're seeking is for our leaders to petition the Lord. And I think, like any good shepherd, they should respond to the needs of their flock.
Do you think your leaders have the mind of God?
Absolutely. And I think they have our best interest in mind and the best interest of the church in mind. I wish that we could sit down and have a dialogue. And I hope in the future that does happen.
To this question of whether you've moved the movement of Mormon feminism or Mormon women forward or set it back. How are you thinking about that right now? Because there are some who are saying she went too far. She was too aggressive. She had to go on the property. She had to do that. And now all the efforts that we've been doing as Mormon women, quietly urging our leaders to move forward, is now going to be set back. What do you say to that?
Well, if you study social movements in any different type of context in history, there are different groups in each social movement that have different tactics, that have different ideas, but are all fighting for the same goal. Suffrage is one of those, where that you had the Elizabeth Cady Stantons and the Susan B. Anthonys, but you also had the Alice Pauls. And I think in every movement, you need to have those. For me, and
you mean the mix of the more sort of extreme and then the sort of softer, more moderate?
I would contend that ordained women is not extreme.
Right, okay,
it's important
okay.
to keep in mind that what we did was literally patiently wait in a line, and when told to leave, we left. So I don't consider that to be particularly extreme, especially in the context of social movements. But given that, I think each group needs to follow their heart and follow the Spirit and do what they feel called to do. And this is what we feel called to do, and we're doing it with absolute sincerity. And they, I think, should continue.
I wonder if you worry now. I mean, I mentioned the nuclear option. Mormons really do feel like excommunication is the thing, but they pulled the trigger on her. And so now I wonder if you worry if those who are just sort of, you know, just peeking a little bit into this idea of feminism, women on the fringes who weren't involved in any kind of organization, any kind of group, hadn't read Mormon women scholars, didn't know anything about that, but felt a little bugged about their role at church or their role at home or any of those kinds of things. And now they're like, boop, they're back. You know, does that worry you?
I have more faith in Mormon women than that. And I think the context has changed. I think the purges in the past caused people to be silenced, caused the conversation to be chilled. But I've been very surprised at the reaction to what's happened to me just in the past 48 hours. Women have been sending in messages in droves. You know, the people who sent, I sent in over 1,000 letters in my defense, and half of those letters were people who said, you know, I don't necessarily agree with ordained women, but what was done to her is wrong. This is wrong. Do not do this. And I think more and more people are coming off the fence, but not on the side of caution or of timidity. They're coming off the fence on the side of not being silenced.
Where do you think this came from? I mean, that's a big question. I mean, was this Bishop Harris and his counselors and your stake president? They seemed bugged, obviously, clearly, by what you had done. But the big question is whether or not they went through with this. That's had a profound impact. And you could argue whether it's negative or positive for the LDS Church, but it's had a profound impact on the public image of the church. Is it possible that just Bishop Harris and his two counselors did this without the input from church headquarters? Do you have an opinion on that?
I mean, it is an opinion because nothing has been confirmed to me. In fact, I sent him an email after I received it and I said, who has reviewed this letter aside from the three people who are in the council with you, or the two people in addition to you? And he never responded. So I'm not sure what his silence means. I find it very hard to believe that the church would allow something so devastating and so widely followed to take place without any input on their part. In addition, there is a very strict priesthood line of authority, and my bishop and stake president have a line leader who has authority over them. And so it's impossible for them to totally abdicate responsibility because there is a structure within the church that says the people above them have authority over them and supervise them.
So how does your role change now that you are, I guess, in a sort of legal way of looking at it, or and it's certainly a technical way of looking at it, you're no longer in the church? So how does your role with ordained women change? Because in some way you were defined by the fact that you were inside. Now you're not.
And when I found out this news, I was at a board meeting of ordained women. We have 8 members on our executive board with varying levels of orthodoxy. Most of them are active, faithful Mormon women. And just because you cut off one head doesn't mean there aren't going to be other people popping up. It's not ordained women is not just me. Ordained women is hundreds and thousands of women who support us. And from what I have seen, none of them are backing down.
So you're not going to appoint a successor, someone who has standing now within the church, and you'll just sort of be a consultant or something like that?
Well, I have no children, so this won't go by bloodlines. we operate on consensus, and I'm just one of the many voices in ordained women.
I wanted to ask you this question about whether or not you saw this in some way as necessary, that on some level you had to, there had to be one person who sacrificed if this had to come, that on some level this almost had to happen for this movement to move forward. There had to be this drastic kind of action. Do you, and that you were the person who's been sacrificed for it all. Do you see it in any way in that way?
I never aspired to a type of martyrdom, and I don't think that it had to go down like this. It didn't have to occur. The church, any reasonable suggestion that was made, we would have considered. You know, if the 6 discussions was something that was particularly problematic, we could have changed the name to 6 conversations. There were a lot of things that we would have been willing to do in order to create a dialogue, and one of those things was not take down the website or totally disband the group because we're speaking out. However, we would have been very amenable, and we are going into the future very amenable to an open dialogue in which we can create a conversation where our views are taken seriously and considered, and at the same time, we don't have to relinquish our authenticity.
So I want to go back to that question we were talking about earlier on the program about that this was an act of faith for you. So as you know that these leaders are meeting on Sunday, I imagine you're pretty prayerful about that, right? That God will be there for you, that God will inspire them to see it your way or certainly see your perspective. And then they excommunicate you. What does that do to your sense of God? What does that do to your sense of faith?
For me, in many ways, my prayer is my work, and I continue to advocate for women because that is my prayer. That is my prayer to God, that we will see total inclusion into the structure of the church, and that will benefit society. That will benefit the countries where we're sending missionaries. That will benefit if all religions, including Mormonism, Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, all of the religions become places of parity, we'll see that reflected in society at large. And that is my prayer.
So what happens? What happens now? Are you going to go to church on Sunday?
I'm living in Provo right now, and my parents are also being punished and targeted. And we went to church last Sunday, and we'll probably go again this Sunday. And I think this is a difficult conversation that we all need to have, and the conversation doesn't stop by trying to make me go away.
What's the part you're going to miss the most?
Oh, that's a very, very, very difficult question. I love, you know, honestly, it's a lot of people say, well, do you want no gender segregated spaces whatsoever? But for me, I love Relief Society. I love being with my sisters. I love teaching. My previous calling most recently was chorister in the Relief Society. And I did that until my last day in my ward. And that's something that I'm really going to miss.
That's Kate Kelly, founder of Ordain Women, joined us here in the studio. Of course, is moving with her husband to Kenya later this summer. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for being with us. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the practical effects in this, well, in the saga of Mormon feminist Kate Kelly. You've heard the news by now. Monday, she was informed that she had been excommunicated from the LDS Church for her activism trying to secure the Mormon priesthood for women. She joined us earlier on the program, and today we're talking about the impact of Kelly's punishment. Has it moved the cause of Mormon feminism forward, or has it set it back? You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Nylan McBain, a blogger and a columnist, founder and editor-in-chief of the Mormon Women Project. It's an online library of interviews with LDS women from around the world. And Nylan McBain, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I asked Kate Kelly her like gut initial reaction to it all. When you heard, what was yours?
I think it was, well, someone in my office described my face going white.
Really?
Yes. I think
because you were surprised?
I was devastated. I have been like many women, I think, who claim a moderate position on gender issues in the church. I think we've been looking at what Kate is doing with a dual sense of gratitude and dismay. And I think it's been a very complex relationship that we've had to what she's doing. On the gratitude side, I think we've understood that she has definitely blown open some areas of conversation that perhaps were before spoken only privately. Mm-hmm. And she brought the conversation into the Relief Societies and into people's homes and into the public sphere in a way that nobody has before. I think we were also fearful because she focused the conversation so completely on one specific request, and she approached it from a point of view of social activism, that anybody familiar with the psychology of church leadership and the history of the way that the church works understood that it's not a democracy. It's not any sort of government that can be lobbied or moved in a particular social direction. And so the complex reaction, I think, was, one of balancing the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. If from my point of view, and I think from the point of view of many moderate women in the church, we understand where she might have crossed the line. We understand the psychology of the leaders. We understand our commitment to be obedient, and that when the church, general church leadership asks you to do something, or your local leadership asks you to do something, you comply because that is the way that you show obedience to God. On the other hand, I think each one of us, for me, I can speak for myself. My heart broke because of the spirit of the law. It felt so wrong.
And it felt so wrong that she was going to be excommunicated.
That she was going to be excommunicated.
Because she's a devout woman, has these profound beliefs, but she did this, she made this sort of, I don't want to diminish it, but made this kind of tactical strategic error.
Absolutely. And I've said from the start that you know, I've disagreed firmly with the tactics and the strategies that ordained women has employed all along. And yet, as I said, you know, I've also hoped that there's room for many points of view in this conversation. And that was certainly devastating to people like me, and I think many like me.
But I want to – it's so interesting to – we talk about Mormon – feminism or the Mormon women's movement as this monolithic group, but I guess it's important to say that's not the case, that they have – there are people like you have a more sort of moderate perspective of the role of women within the LDS Church. Kate Kelly, who talked about the fact that she doesn't at all regard her perspective as extreme. She mentioned, look, we're standing in a line, big deal. But mm-hmm. but I guess some would say that that is the one end for sure. Mm-hmm. And then you have others who are – wouldn't even call themselves Mormon feminists, but get bugged at sacrament meeting or yeah. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you seems like you're all over the map.
I think we are, and that's part of the reason that this is so complex. I myself certainly defended Kate to detractors on a number of occasions, saying she wasn't actually going off and ordaining women herself. It's not like she was laying her hands on anybody's head. If that were the case, then I think many of us would have come to the conclusion much earlier that this was, in fact, an egregious apostasy. But she wasn't doing that, and so that, again, is why it's so complicated. On the other hand, I think that many of us would say that what we felt there was a value in the ordained women movement is there was, I think, at its best moments, it currently continues to exist, so I'll talk about it in the present tense, certainly. It is an effort to create an egalitarian structure for church administration. And I think that there are many women who would love to see us move more in that direction. I myself would love to see us move more in that direction. I have a very different way of moving in that direction than to tackle the doctrine that underpins that administrative structure.
And you think there is a doctrine there that suggests women should not have the priesthood, that they have another role?
Well, I heard you ask the other day the church public affairs representative if there is a doctrine that women cannot have the priesthood. And I would suggest that, you know, in the Doctrine and Covenants, there are very specific delineations of men's responsibilities. And the doctrine is much more of omission than it is the actual yeah. mention that women cannot participate. However, I think we also have to take
into consideration. And there's a lot of male personal pronouns connected to it. But other than that, what is there?
Well, I think we have to also take into consideration the fact that throughout scriptural history, the responsibility of maintaining ordinances has always been given to a specific group of people. You know, obviously in the earliest days, it was given to one family, the Levites. And through the course of history that has expanded
and changed. So
yes.
are you conceding that it's possible?
I have always conceded that it's possible.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. What I do think, though, is that one step to making that even a possibility, if we want that, and if that is something that the prophet ultimately decides for us, is that we as a community and a culture need to recognize what falls under priesthood authority and what perhaps has been over enthusiastically embraced under the rubric of priesthood authority.
Are you saying that in some ways, look, like it or not, this is how the system works. It's like the Titanic. It's massive. It's led by men who came of age in the Eisenhower administration.
Absolutely.
They have certain perspectives about women. You know, they expected dinner when they got home, right? And this is the way it works. And so if there's going to be any change, just be patient. patient?
Well, I work very hard to get into the minds of the people or the community that I'm trying to talk to. And for instance—
Within the church.
Within the church. Yeah. And for instance, I like to use the example of 1962 when the Mormon Tabernacle Choir performed in front of Mount Rushmore, and the recording was included in a time capsule. And the New York Times said a couple years ago on the anniversary of this event that at no point in history has the Mormon Church ever aligned more closely with American values than at that moment. That was 1962. If you look at 1962, the kinds of laws that were on our books in this country for the treatment of women, the way that they were represented in the media, the way that stewardesses were routinely fired, the expectations of women in academia and at home and in the workplace— President Monson was about 6 months away from becoming an apostle in 1962. So he had already had his formative experiences growing up as a man in the church.
So what you're saying is be empathetic. These guys have a perspective.
Absolutely. They have a perspective.
Give him a break? Is that what you're saying?
Well, on the one hand. On the other hand, I will say just as quickly that even with the speed of women's progress over the past 50 years, there is far more to do, and it is our responsibility to move that forward. However, I think my tactic is to move that forward more slowly, I think, and to recognize that there may be bridges and stepping stones that we have not yet taken that will prepare our people for a day when there may be more structural egalitarian practices.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to get to a couple of things here because you said something that I found intriguing. The big question, and I put this to Kate Kelly earlier, was where did this come from? Was this just Bishop Harris and his counselors there in Vienna, Virginia, independently acting within their sort of priesthood stewardship or whatever it is to do this thing? Or were they directed in some way, whether directly or indirectly, from church headquarters? That's the big question. Now, I won't get you to speculate on that matter, but I do. You did say this, that you believe church leadership hopes that innovation does happen on a local level?
I firmly believe that.
What do you mean? Because I don't think there's an institution in America that is more correlated and centralized than Mormonism. I can't imagine church leaders would say, yes, let's be religious spiritual innovators in our wards and branches.
What I like to hang on to, Doug, is there's a section in the Handbook 2, which is the guidelines that every member of the church has access to for how the church should be run on the local level. And there's a section about adapting practices and policies to the needs of the people in that particular congregation. And I like to grasp onto this idea that the major shift that I think would be most beneficial for us as a culture right now is to not read the handbook from a point of view of fear and saying, I have an idea. Let me go see if the handbook says that I can do that. And then go to the handbook and you see, oh, it doesn't actually specify that the young women can go visiting teaching with their mothers. So I'm not going to do that. That's sort of the mindset that I think maybe we've historically been in over the past couple of decades. What I would love to see, and I think it would actually be a seismic shift. It sounds so small, but I think it would make a big difference if we go to the handbook and we say, wow, I have an idea, and the handbook doesn't say I can't do this. So I'm going to do it. And I think I think that is the kind of thing that this adaptability section in the handbook is pointing to. I also think that, again, some people say that these are very small elements, but I think they really contribute to our quality of life. I like to point out our general leadership and show how in many ways they have actually made more deliberate steps to see and include women than we have on the local level. For instance, at the last conference, all of the female general officers were moved to the center of the conference stand and all of the apostles' wives were moved up to the stand so that they were really front and center.
Do you think that would have happened if Kate Kelly's group hadn't been engaged?
I do because I know—
You think it would have?
Well, I don't know if it would have happened now. It may have happened in a couple of years, but I know for a fact that there are women who have the ear of the brethren who have been advocating for these things for many years, frustratingly many years. I'm the first to admit that.
Right. So the big question then, of course, did this situation, Kate Kelly now being excommunicated, has that set back the movement of Mormon women or moved it forward? What do you think?
I think we had a tentative alliance between the general leadership, the members, the conservatives, progressives, the men, the women, that up until about 2 weeks ago, which I was thoroughly enjoying and which I thought was extremely productive. I do love the analogy Kate makes about knocking and how that is an active a verb and does require action. However, I think that there are stories in the scriptures that also caution us against asking too much. The story of Martin Harris comes to mind in the Doctrine and Covenants, where he ultimately got what he wanted, but it wasn't the best thing. And there was an opportunity cost to asking.
Wait, you're not saying if we asked God right now, if these brethren asked God, God would say, no, it's not, we're not there yet. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, I'm referencing something that Elder Holland says, which is you can either get what you want or you can get something better. And sometimes I have to have faith that's true, that there may be an opportunity cost to actually getting what I want.
But isn't what you're saying, doesn't that presume that God is not ready to give women the Mormon priesthood yet?
I believe that.
You believe that?
I do believe that.
God is like, we're not ready yet.
I do believe that.
This is 2014.
And I also believe that Elder Oakes' talk in last conference was as close as we're going to get to an answer to that.
Which is, just explain what you mean by that for those.
Well, Elder Oakes, and it was unfortunate that it was a priesthood. I don't know if that's because that's the session he had been assigned to previously, and so he just had to use the opportunity that
a little
was given
ironic.
To him. It was ironic. But he did specify distinctions between priesthood authority, priesthood power, priesthood keys, all of which I think are important. And he almost rhetorically asked, by what power do women work today if it's not priesthood power? And I thought that without saying in so many words, that was our answer. I am the first to say that I wish that over the past 2 weeks we had had a mechanism in church communication to be able to hear healing, specific, comforting, directional words from the prophets and apostles that we crave to follow and crave to hear from. And I feel that in many ways, one of the things that this episode has done more than anything is sort of underscore the communications process of church leadership to its members as it contrasts to the communication process of really any other thought leader in our country and in our world to members. We can go on Twitter at any moment in the day and know what some New York Times columnist is thinking or some great leader of head of state is thinking. And we crave that same sort of personal connection with our prophets and apostles. And I know that I personally and many others like me over the past couple of weeks have craved that and have felt that maybe there is a communication lag in the way that that church leadership can scripturally is mandated to communicate with the body of the church.
That's Nylan McBain, founder and editor of the Mormon Women Project, joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're running behind, but we need to take a break, so we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the effects of the story that Mormon feminist Kate Kelly has been excommunicated from her church, trying to figure out the impact of all of that. Joining us now on the program is Amanda Hendricks Komodo. She is an historian and a blogger with the Mormon history blog Juvenile Instructor. Earlier this month, she co-authored a post called A History of Women's Excommunication. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan, and she's joining us from the studios of NPR member station Michigan Radio there in Ann Arbor. And Amanda Hendricks Komodo, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to sort of jump into I wanted to go back to this question of 1993, where it's been sort of referred to as a purge. A number of Mormon historians and prominent Mormon feminists at the time were also excommunicated. And I'm wondering, what effect did that have? Excommunications have generated so much fear, you've talked about. And the effect you've said is that that essentially that in 1993 that put back Mormon studies some 10 years. Explain what you mean.
Well, I think what's important to realize is that the 1980s and the 1990s had been a really, really formative moment for Mormon women's scholarship. In the years late 1980s, early 1990s, we'd seen dozens of books published on Mormon women's history, telling us about the early history of the Relief Society, about Mormon women going east during the 19th century with a church calling to become doctors. We'd seen publications on Mother in Heaven, on Mormon women in the 19th century giving blessings. There'd been a real surgence of Mormon women wanting to talk about their own history. And then when the excommunications happened, I think there was a fear that set in that it could be me next. And women who had a church calling that they were deeply involved in or who were employed by the church or were invested in their community and couldn't imagine being excommunicated took a step back. And the scholarship on Mormon women, although it didn't completely disappear, stopped for a little bit. And women who would have went into maybe Mormon studies or Mormon theology or Mormon history – did something else instead. Perhaps they went to law school. Perhaps they went and studied another area of American history, which left those of us who came up afterwards and wanted to work on Mormon women's history without a lot of mentors. And so it created this gap where now we have a lot of older women who worked on it in the 80s and 90s, and then we have a 10-year gap, and then we have a whole bunch of young women who are now working on Mormon women's history, but no one in the middle. And so a lot of the mentorship that you would usually see in a thought community or an intellectual community just isn't there.
So with that in mind, I imagine you may be worried about the next 10 years in Mormon feminism, Mormon scholarship, the mentors who are emerging now that this – now, let's make it clear. It's only been one excommunication.
Right.
But – so it would be unfair to call it a purge at this point. We do know others are facing – possibly facing anyway discipline. But are you worried about that now, that this could – the same thing could happen?
I think the internet has changed the game a bit, although maybe not as much as we would like.
Huh.
What I've noticed on social media is that there are some women who may not have spoken out beforehand but have felt as though the church's decision to excommunicate Kate Kelly or her local leader's decision to excommunicate Kate Kelly has made the question a moral one for them. And so therefore, they cannot sit by and watch as she is being excommunicated and not say something. And the Ordained Women website, Facebook, the Feminist Mormon Housewives groups have given these women a space to connect with each other that they wouldn't have otherwise have. On the other hand, I have seen some silencing where women who are either employed at BYU-Idaho or BYU or who work for the Church History Library feel like they have too much to lose and that they can't speak out. And if they were to do so, their employment would be on the line. And so I think what you see is not necessarily a polarization, but there's been some distance created in which you have some women who are being who have been given a lot of courage and who feel need to speak out because of Kate Kelly, and other women who have been silenced. And so I don't think that we're going to see the same lack of mentors, but I do think that it may end up decreasing the amount of diversity within that community and those who feel willing to speak.
Have you thought about what would happen if some of these women didn't back off? Not with the Ordained Women group, for example, that they knew that the nuclear option has been used now with Kate Kelly, but they said, we're plowing forward. We know based on, and this may be the internet, we know there are kindred spirits out there, dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of them out there. I mean, can you imagine the church would allow what could be potentially dozens or hundreds of these kinds of disciplinary actions?
I don't see the church going that direction, and I don't think that it's done so historically either. At the last Mormon History Association conference, we had a session on the Equal Rights Amendment. Me, Andrea Redke-Moss, and Natalie Rose presented on the Equal Rights Amendment, and then the audience was filled with Mormon women who had also been pro-ERA and had remained active in the church. They hadn't faced church discipline, even though Sonia Johnson, who is sort of famous for her opposition to the church and to the church's opposition to the equal rights movement, but they hadn't been excommunicated because even though they'd been vocal, even though they'd been publishing, they hadn't seen the same search censure because the church couldn't risk excommunicating hundreds of women because that would have galvanized an even bigger movement. One woman made a martyr, but excommunicating dozens of them was just sort of bureaucratically, institutionally impossible. And I don't think that they're going to do that again. I think they're hoping, whoever the they that made this decision is that this will sort of set an example and set the parameters and set the boundaries. I don't think just institutionally the church can afford to have hundreds of women being excommunicated because then you have hundreds of wards that know these women, that know that they're not sort of these radical people who Kate Kelly has sort of made out to be sometimes, and would feel empathy because that's the woman that they know. That's their sister in Christ. That's the woman who baked cookies for them during visiting teaching.
Let me read a couple of emails, and we're getting a lot. I'm not going to be able to get to a fraction of them, but a few make some points that I wanted to go over with you, Amanda Hendricks-Komodo. Here's from Julie. She writes, "I'm part of the silent generation that hit college age just as the excommunications of 93 happened." She writes, "Some of my best professors were part of that purge, and it scared me and many others into the shadows. Thanks to the internet, though, and to brave women like Kate," she writes, "I have found people who share our concerns, and we have hope again." So this Julie expresses this sense that as opposed to retreating, there possibly could be this kind of emboldening sense among some women.
And I think that will be true for some women. I think what's going to determine for a lot of women whether they speak out is their own personal situation. What's their employment situation? What's their own position within their ward? How much exposure have they had to feminism? How comfortable do they feel with feminism? I don't necessarily think that we're going to see a widespread falling away or a widespread galvanization. I think that it's going to in some ways be an individual choice, and that you're going to see some women who either work for the church or have husbands with high leadership callings who feel that they can't speak out, and other women who are going to feel like Kate Kelly's excommunication sort of forces them to speak. But I think that for a lot of women who are within the Mormon feminist community, it's more than just their church membership on the line. If they lose their church membership, they lose a whole lot more. Their employment, their community, their faith, everything goes. And although that's possible for some people to imagine, for other people, it's just simply too much to lose.
Is it a mix? Is that how change works within the LDS church, is that you have this, on one hand, more extreme agitators who are pushing something like ordination, obviously for Kate Kelly's perspective, or then you have the Nylan McBains who are saying, we want change, but we're not quite willing to go that far. And is that how it works? Is you have to have those two elements in order to get this big, massive institution to start to shift?
Well, and I don't think it's actually just the church. Kate Kelly made reference to Alice Paul, who I think is actually a really important figure to look at. Alice Paul was a radical suffrage leader in the early 20th century who went farther than a lot of American suffragists were willing to do at the time and held sit-ins at the White House. She was willing to sort of heckle politicians as they went around on their stump speeches. And it was her radical acts that made the more conservative suffrage leaders suddenly seem respectable and made politicians willing to speak with them. And I think it's way too soon to say whether or not Kate Kelly will ultimately be an Alice Paul type figure. But I do think there are a lot of interesting parallels in that I think in some ways Kate Kelly has widened the conversation and has made it possible to speak about women's equality and women's rights within the church. And even though it may have pushed her in the eyes of the church outside of the line, it's made some more moderate voices, although I think calling Kate Kelly a radical is pushing it a bit too far.
Right. She would agree.
Right. I mean, what she's doing, I spend a lot of time in women's studies circles.
Yeah.
Kate Kelly is not a radical feminist.
Right.
But I think it's made a lot of the more moderate voices within the church more respectable and has made some people willing to listen to them that wouldn't have been willing to do so without Kate Kelly.
Here's an email from KC who writes, "Kate Kelly is not the problem. Her actions are simply a symptom of the larger issue. Women, she writes, who want to be involved, who want more understanding of Heavenly Mother, we need something better than excommunicating those who bring it up, she says. I myself have not been a radical so far, but if things do not improve drastically and soon in the way our program is set up for young women, which is an organization within the church, mm-hmm. I cannot, she writes, in good conscience raise my family this way. It's like Casey, and I wonder if you think others are kind of on a tipping point and this may tip them one way or another.
I've heard similar sentiments from a lot of women who are worried about not necessarily themselves because they're already adults. They can deal with what's going on in the church, but for their daughters. And that's something I can really sympathize with. What do you say to your 8 or your 9-year-old about Kate Kelly? What do you say to someone who's been told she can be anything that she wants to be, but when she goes to church, watches her brothers and only her brothers pass the sacrament, or who thinks, you know, one day I would like to be a leader within the Mormon church, only to be told, well, that might be possible, but you can only be a certain type of leader. And a lot of my friends who have left the church left over feminist issues. Mm. And so I think that is a real issue, and that the church is losing a lot of young girls and young women because of feminist issues. And it's going to bring the issue more and more to the forefront as their mothers and their fathers and their family members say, I don't want to see my daughter go. She's too much to lose. And that may be what ultimately pushes the church to change.
Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. As a sort of just the public relations impact of this for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I once heard this described. In fact, last night someone described this as a lose-lose. Didn't work for Kate Kelly, yeah. And it was a lose for the LDS Church. You figure that's true?
It's hard to imagine what they could have done that wouldn't have incited a public reaction. If you let her keep demonstrating on – or not demonstrating because she wouldn't use those words herself. If you right. let her keep asking for admission to the priesthood session – then she draws attention to the inequality that's there. If you excommunicate her, you create her as a martyr and as a public figure that shows that what she's been claiming is in some ways true, that women are being judged by men and aren't allowed to have the voice that they would like to have. Some people have suggested that perhaps if the church had – or the leaders of the church had went into a room and said, we are going to pray now and we're going to do this prayerfully, and then come back and said, you know, we prayed – and we are so sorry, but it's not time yet, that may have sort of quieted the movement. But it's hard to say. Tensions were so high that it's hard for me to imagine a way that the church comes out completely ahead in this. I think that in order for it to work, there has to be some sort of compromise. And without compromise, I'm not sure how the church could have come ahead in a public relations scenario.
Historian Amanda Hendricks Komodo. She co-authored A History of Women's Excommunication for the Mormon blog Juvenile Instructor. Joined us today from Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we invite you to continue the conversation. You can go to our website and discuss, as you have been doing for the past several days. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea, the program directed today by Tim Slover and Michael Havey, produced, of course, by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.